Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I'm sorry for only arriving so late yesterday. And I've been up since 3 o'clock. I'd like to thank the organizers very much for giving me the opportunity to give this talk. And I appreciate especially that it was put on this important day, which I'm sure, as everyone here knows and celebrates, is the national holiday in Germany. The basic topic of what I'm going to talk about is intermediate energy excitations in magnets. And what I mean by surprising usefulness of spin waves is that they are useful there in a regime where you might have not entirely expected, or where many people might not have expected them to be particularly useful. So basically, this is the general ideological outline. We have, as a matter of course, that quasi-particles exist, and there are some good reasons why quasi-particles do exist, but there are also many settings where they may not exist. And one of the questions, of course, is do we think that quasi-particles are ubiquitous because we don't understand the situations where they don't exist very well, so we focus on the ones where they do? That's what I'm trying to work towards is the question, is there some sense generic behavior away from the universal limit where we have good and well understood reasons for quasi-particles to exist and to be useful? Okay, and I'm using spin waves as an example in part because thanks to neutron scattering experiments, they are highly accessible, and especially with developments in the last 10 years in inelastic neutron scattering, there are really a lot of very accurate by comparison to previous years, results available. And since materia science gives us all these different systems, we can study them sort of in a tunable environment. Okay, I haven't done all of this work by myself. I'm going to talk mainly honeycomb lattice, triangular lattice, and pyroclore lattice, and it turns out that these are separate collaborations. So in the honeycomb lattice, the topological magnons were in large part started by Paul McClarty, but we've had lots of discussions at the Institute with several people. And the triangular lattice, most of the work was done in two theses by Matthias Gohlke, who's now at OIST, and Ruben Veresen, who's now at Harvard. They were both graduate students, and together with me and Frank Polman. And the pyroclore lattice was a completely different thing, so the authors of a preprint on NCNF got in touch for feedback, and then we decided to look at the dynamics here. The main people were Hitesh Changlani and Xu Zhang, and Ken Plum did a lot of the experiments and the analysis. Okay, so I don't think I need to go over this in any particular detail. And I'm going to look at our magnons as example of quasi-particles, and I'm going to ask what happens at finite energies away from the hydrodynamic limit. Okay, so the square lattice is something that you're all familiar with, and this is the context in which most people learn about spin waves. When, in, say, in a graduate condensed matter course, you learn about Hertzsprung-Primakov bosons. I'm not going to go into all that much detail here, other than saying that this is an example where even at high energies, you have got very sharp excitations. They're not perfectly sharp, but basically, if you take a single particle picture, you get a very single particle magnon picture, you get a very good impression of what's going on across the entire spectrum, across the entire Brillouin zone. And often, this is thought of as an example of this is why spin waves are useful, because single magnon wave functions essentially tell you what happens across most of the spectrum. But I'm going to give you some example in what follows that even beyond the simple setting of a collinear unfrustrated magnet, spin waves are very useful. Okay, and so the first item I would like to present to you are topological magnons on the honeycomb lattice. So as far as single particle properties are concerned, of course, the quantum statistics of the particle involved doesn't play all that much of a role. So as far as the band structure of magnons is concerned, you can classify them in pretty much the same way as you classify the well-known fermionic bands. And then you will not be surprised to hear that non-trivial topologies are possible. So the very simplest case is if you've got a ferromagnet on the honeycomb lattice, then you the effective dispersion is just given by the hopping problem on the honeycomb lattice, which of course is where graphene's Dirac points come in. And you can then ask, okay, if I say go through the if I apply field and I fully polarize a honeycomb magnet, do I have a chance of seeing Dirac points? And this is, so a topological feature like Dirac points is something you might want to see with neutron scattering. So whereas neutron scattering isn't really good enough yet to see things like surface modes, which nonetheless you can hope to see features which are characteristic of, say, a Dirac point by simply tuning your neutron energy. So even though you've got bosons, and the bosons mean that you can't just put your Fermi energy and park it wherever you like and then do something like ARPIS, but here nonetheless with neutrons you can target the excited states around the Dirac points, and what you see if you do this, so this is a numerical calculation, is that you see these kind of boomerang type structures, the orientation of which evolves with energy, and this would be a qualitative thing to look for if you're interested in finding these kind of Dirac points in putative topological magnet. Okay, so and this may be a very useful first way of approaching topological band structures of bosonic particles such as magnons. Okay, but then of course there's a fly in the ointment, which is just because I can write down a single particle dispersion doesn't actually mean that my single particles are particularly stable or indeed are particularly useful descriptions at high energies. So this just comes back to the idea of low energies, that hydrodynamics guarantees that you have useful descriptions in terms of these quasi-particles, but this may not be the case at high energies. And in fact, in spin wave theory, it's a commonly held belief, and it's also a quite well-founded belief, that the higher in energy that you go, the less well-defined your single magnon dispersion becomes. And one of the things that was realized a long time ago, and worked out in a lot of detail by Sasha Chernyshov and Mike Zdumirsky, is the important role that kinematics plays. So let me first, so the question is, away from the low-energy asymptotics, what is it that happens to magnons? And the expectation is that anything may happen, because you no longer have universal principles to guide you. But the aim now is to be a little bit more precise and ask, what are the things which on which it depends what actually happens? Okay, so one thing that's important is the existence of decay channels, because in quantum mechanics, the basic belief is that if decays can happen, they will. So unless your matrix element is zero, whatever process it describes is going to play a role in what you're looking at. And so kinematically, if you are constrained by momentum and energy conservation, and this constraint still allows you to have decays, then your magnons will decay and you're going to get broad excitations rather than, like a resonance rather than a well-defined single particle excitation. And here's an experiment about 10 or 15 years old where you see a single magnon mode entering the continuum and broadening considerably. Okay, and so a lot of effort has been invested in understanding in which settings you actually do get kinematic decays, and then the expectation is that if you kinematically can get decays, that they're going to happen. So you try to identify decay regions, and then say outside these decay regions, you actually have long-lived magnon excitations. So are the topological magnons stable? And if you do linear spin wave theory, they are stable, because linear spin wave theory describes stable magnons. Their instabilities are beyond linear spin wave theory. But then if you do the kinematics, you're sort of disappointed. Actually, you find that decays are kinematically allowed, and you don't expect to see these things. If you do nonlinear spin wave theory, things look a little bit better. The bandwidth gets renormalized. And if you then work things out kinematically, in fact, for an appropriate choice of parameters, the topological magnons can survive. Now, if you do the same thing with a 2D DMRG code and you compare the two settings, what you find is that actually, so this is now the spectral function obtained from DMRG on a finite circumference infinite length cylinder, what you find is that you have well-defined single magnon excitations, which is not what you have expected based on kinematic consideration. So this is an example where the cooperative physics captured, say, by nonlinear spin wave theory actually leads to renormalizations, which give you longer lifetimes of the quasi-particles. And as I'll argue next, this is actually much more generic than you might have thought. So it's not just that one got lucky here, there's actually a systematic mechanism for these things to happen. Okay, but this poses the questions, what are the general conditions for spin wave survival? So now let's go to the triangular lattice, which is sort of the Heisenberg model on the triangular lattice is the Ising model of spin wave decays. So there's the spin a half model, which took a little while to establish, but which is now believed to be magnetically ordered, even though with a reduced ordered moment, so you're guaranteed to have a low energy Goldstone mode. And you can describe it, when I mean effectively classical, I mean that the low energy physics is basically the physics of the fluctuations around the large ordered moment. The ordered moment is basically so big that you can have an effective classical description, which is essentially what underpins the validity of spin wave theory. Then you can ask what happens at high energies, and then this decays much more easily than the square lattice. So again, you can do large S like in the square lattice, and then you predict that kinematically you have a large decay region here marked in blue. This has been much studied, but it occurred to me that no one had actually really directly verified whether the spin waves are unstable across this entire decay region. So this is what we decided to do first when we had our 2D DMRG code. So this was the technological process progress. We had cylinders available up to size 10 by infinity. We can do finite times up to roughly 10 times 1 over j. And one thing that is still a technological problem, so this works better for anisotropic systems. So we did put a small anisotropy in so that the big decay region, which is shown here, has actually been reduced to the small decay region, which is sort of shaded in there, but it's still a good fraction of the total Brillouin zone. And what we find if you just look at this, so here's the linear spin wave theory, one particle dispersion and two particle continuum. You see that the one particle dispersion comfortably enters into the two particle continuum over a broad part of the Brillouin zone. But what you actually find from the numerics is that the mode avoids the two particle continuum and remains well defined, even in the place where kinematically, based on the linear spin wave theory, you would have expected it to go away and decay. Okay, so this was the central surprise in all of this. So even though there was the expectation of a large decay region, actually a single magnon mode has continued to be identifiable in numerical simulations in the region where you would have expected decay. Okay, here's the basic picture. It's very simple. So if you basically have a single mode, and so the basic idea is that if you've got sufficiently strong interactions between a single mode and a two-particle continuum, rather than having the level which goes through the continuum decay, it actually gets repelled, ejected out of the two-particle continuum, and you get avoided decay in the same way that you get, say, avoided level crossings. So in other words, this cartoon picture, this does not correspond to a calculation. If you've got a mode, two-particle continuum, if they don't interact, they don't know of each other, so they just get superposed. If you've got weak coupling, so small matrix elements between them, you get this picture that is correctly expected, that you, as soon as you can have decay, you will have decay, but when the coupling becomes stronger, you actually get avoided decay and the mode survives. Okay, so this is the central result of this part, and I'm going to flesh this out in the next few slides. So one thing you can basically do is take this picture a little bit, but not all that much more seriously. So you basically say, I'm now treating that line as completely divorced from the two-particle continuum. So you basically get rid of the self-consistency of the two-particle continuum being made up of one-particle states. So you don't renormalize both of them at the same in a self-consistent way. And then what you find is that the qualitative behavior depends on only some very simple gross features, namely the dimensionality of your system, because that influences densities of states, and also the onset of the density of states at the bottom of the two-particle continuum. But the basic idea, at any rate, is that there's level repulsion. So if there are enough levels and they are coupled strongly enough to the level which wants to enter, then it gets repelled out of the continuum, whereas if the coupling is only weak, basically only a very small amount of weight gets pushed down and most of the weight goes into a decaying mode into the continuum. Okay, so this is basically the central result. Depending on details, either an infinitesimal interaction between mode and continuum may be enough, or you might need a finite interaction strength in order to eject the level.
And so this was done using actual spin wave coupling?
No, okay, so this is essentially taking a very simple model where you've got a continuum which is uniformly coupled to the mode, so you basically have a 1 by n matrix. N is the continuum, 1 is the mode. The off-diagonal terms are just one row and one column of 1s. And then there's the energy difference, which is in the diagonal, and you just diagonalize that. So this is completely straightforward. Okay, where's this from? I see. I think this comes from a calculation like this, and I'm going to show you next what an actual spin calculation does, right? Okay, so moving from this toy model towards spin systems, the next one is, again, a pretty artificial system, but one where you can tune everything that you need separately. So in the top row, you've got a paramagnet in the field so that the excited states are single spin flips. The bottom is an easing ferromagnet so that the excited states are domain wall. And then you have a coupling which flips two spins at the same time. And then you can see that you can couple a single excitation in the top row into a single flipped spin into a pair of domain walls in the bottom row. And so this is, you can 1DD mod G that. And then what you see, if the coupling gamma V gets stronger, it's more coupling. As I said, you enter and the things decay, and at larger gamma, it just gets depressed downwards. Okay, so that's the calculation which was done here. Okay, this is the proof of principle that this is actually true for an appropriate spin system. Then you can actually look for signatures of this in existing experiments, but since I only got half an hour, I'm going to skip this one, and I'm going to go to another experiment, which is that in liquid helium. Liquid helium is a very beautiful experiment for this. So, of course, everything I said about magnons is not specific to magnons. It's just a question about continua and couplings between a mode and a continuum. And the nice thing about liquid helium is that it's very accurately measured. There's lots of data available, and the continuum is very simple because unlike these magnets I've been talking about, this doesn't live on a lattice, so the energy onset is essentially, the continuum is essentially independent of wave vector, so it's very easy to locate. So here you've got the roton minimum of helium, and then you see as the mode, and this is actual existing data, as the mode wants to enter the continuum, it actually gets depressed downwards and hugs the bottom of the continuum, which, as I said, is horizontal, so it's rather easy to see. And this data is then accurate enough that you can extract a number of quantities at the same time, so you can fit the roton dispersion curve, assuming that it basically just continues from what it was doing down here. And then you can look at the renormalized energy, at the various energies, in particular the bound state energy below, the bare energy is EB and E star is the actual energy. And then you can derive a simple relation between these quantities, which basically tells you how much weight there is down there as a function of how much the mode has been renormalized. And you can plot this here. So the weight of the quasi-particle with respect to the energy width, energy renormalization, and what you find is that there's a nice line exactly as predicted from theory. So this is an example where the theory that I've just showed you with this very simple level repulsion idea can extract a relation between quantities in existing helium experiments, which people simply hadn't noticed because no one realized that there was this connection to be made between these different quantities. So in other words, this is another example for how this picture of level ejection from the continuum gives quantitative predictions, which presumably are generic in the sense that if you look at this with any other excitation, you're going to get similar behavior. Okay, how am I doing for time? How much?
I think you still
have 12 minutes. Okay, very good. Okay, good. So then let me go from two dimensions to three dimensions. So so what I've shown you so far are really quite conventional magnets. So topologies entered in the case of the honeycomb magnet and the topological band structure, but this is still a single particle interacting band structure and so on. The triangular magnet is really, it's one of the more complex, simple ordered magnets, but it's still a simple ordered magnet. It simply has an ordered moment at root 3 by root 3 unit cell. Okay, so let's now go to magnets where we don't really know what happens. And so I'd like to present to you a candidate spin liquid on the pyrochlore lattice. So you know the pyrochlore lattice is popular as it hosts quite a lot of known spin liquids. So in particular, the classical magnets have spin ice, which is a Coulomb spin liquid, and also the Heisenberg magnet happens to be a three-flavor Coulomb spin liquid. So for an n-component spin, you simply have n emergent U1-gauge fields. And arguably, this is the first and also still one of the very few magnets where all these properties have been demonstrated in a considerable amount of detail. So a material which has been studied in the last few years is this nickel material. So it's a transition metal pyrochlor. The nickel 2 plus on the B side, pyrochlor lattice, has a spin 1, whereas the A side, just in order to keep the valence counting straight, needs a mixture of sodium and calcium ions. The basic upshot is this is a highly frustrated system in the sense that the Curie-Weiss temperature is 130 Kelvin, whereas the nothing happens down to a freezing temperature of 3.5 Kelvin, and the nature of the freezing transition and the origins are currently not particularly well understood, other than that we know that there's disorder, so, you know, it's perhaps what you'd expect. Okay, that's basically a frustrated magnet, spin 1, and perhaps a spin liquid. Yeah, it's believed to be in a solid solution. I'm not actually sure how well this is established, but I don't think there are any indications that it's not a solid solution. Okay, now I'm going to present to you a spin wave theory for this, but I'd first like to prepare you by giving you a lot of arguments why really it's not a good idea to do spin waves on the pyrochlor lattice. So it shouldn't work for a number of reasons. So the reasons that we know for spin wave theory is A, if you've got long-range order, you have Goldstone modes. So this does not have long-range order, so you wouldn't expect Goldstone modes. The second one is what I told you about kinematics. You know, we said, oh, okay, if a mode enters the continuum, then it starts decaying, and then you can ask, at what wave vectors and at what energies does this mode enter the continuum? And the answer is, at all wave vectors at zero energy, right? So if you just do classical spin wave theory, you expect the range of where it applies to be really about as small as it can possibly be, so it applies nowhere. Okay? And then if you believe that spin waves are really controlled in 1 over s as a small parameter, or 1 over z times s as a small parameter, that's also pretty problematic because the spin here is spin 1 and the coordination is 6, which is relatively low for a three-dimensional system, and it's frustrated on top of that. Okay, so now let's get some guidance from theory. So what does the Heisenberg spin 1 magnet actually look like at zero temperature? And I think it's fair to say, don't think there's anyone in the audience who believes that someone knows what the ground state of a spin 1 Heisenberg magnet is. I certainly don't, although there are some indications that it may be a quantum spin liquid. And if you don't know what the ground state is, you probably also don't know what the dynamics does. So what we can, however, do is then ask experiment, because experiment does tell you what the dynamics does, and then we're going to get information from neutron scattering. Okay, but basically, so the main ingredients are there are lots of reasons to believe that spin wave theory fails, and in particular, I think I just skipped that here. I'd like to emphasize this expectation that the two-particle continuum starts at zero energy comes from the fact that if you ask, what is the size of the ground state of a classical pyrochlor magnet, then it contains a quarter of all the degrees of freedom. And the ground states, there are many ground states which are all completely disordered. And since there are a quarter of the degrees of freedom within the ground state, that means that there are basically a quarter of the degrees of freedom at zero energy. And so basically you can add these in any particular ways. Way, the total energy is always going to remain zero, and the total momentum, since you've got basically an entire Brillouin zone's worth of soft modes, is also not a kinematic constraint anymore. Okay, so that's basically the basis for what's happening here. Okay, spin dynamics experiments. So it's found that at low temperatures, 90% of the spectral weight still fluctuates. So even where the system is frozen, it really isn't particularly frozen. And then you see what we know and love about spin liquids. So all the features are broad. Total spin length, the total moment is in keeping with what you would have expected from a spin-only spin 1. And as I said, the disorder physics isn't entirely clear. And so here you see the pinch points and all these kind of broad features that we are used to from these settings. Okay, and so then what Plum and collaborators did is they modeled this via Monte Carlo and the self-consistent Gaussian approximation, fit the equal time correlators, and what they found was actually a very strongly dominant nearest neighbor Heisenberg exchange and then weak anisotropy and some small amount of next nearest neighbor interaction. So basically here's the comparison between the experimental data and the numerical data. Okay, so how do you model spin dynamics on that? So I'm going to do one gross simplification for which I don't have a justification, which is I'm just going to look at this like a classical magnet. So this is work which goes back quite a long way. So in the thesis by Joe Conlon, he did an effective theory, basically a dynamical version of the self-consistent Gaussian approximation, supplemented it by molecular dynamics simulations, and then extracted the full dynamical structure factor. What I'm going to do is something a little bit more simple. So here's the inelastic neutron scattering data in the HHL plane, which is what's normally plotted for the pyroclaw magnets. These contains all the high symmetry directions. Okay, thanks. And so here are the results for different values of the neutron energy. So this is the dynamical structure factor at 0.5 millielectron volt, 2, 4, and 8 millielectron volts. Again, you see the broad features which get washed out ever more as you go lower and higher in energy. If you look very hard, you can also find the half moons, which a couple of groups predicted to be around last year. So they were already here in experiments at the same time. And now what we did for theory are two different theories. So one is we do just a classical Hamiltonian. We cool it to low temperatures, and then we do linear spin wave theory on top of a disordered ground state that we find. This is this this column. And the second thing is we do the Landau-Lifshitz equations of motion around the same ground states in this column here. Okay, and so this is omega cuts in Q space. These are lines in Q space, omega, and then force color plots of the neutron scattering intensity, and the three columns are always the same thing. Okay, so first of all, if you zoom out a little bit and you don't look too hard, I think it's reasonable to say that the agreement is unreasonably good. So many of the features that you can qualitatively make out are reproduced by the theory from the numerics here. The other thing that you find is that linear spin wave theory and molecular dynamics are extremely similar. So molecular dynamics, in some sense, is the full nonlinear time evolution. Linear spin wave theory is the linearized version, and you see that they sort of agree. So of course, false color plots can hide a lot. So what I'm showing here now is frequency, three different points in Q space, and then a fully normalized neutron scattering structure factor. So there's no fitting parameters at all in this curve. And whereas the big peak in the center is basically at low energies incorrectly rendered, you see that there's a lot of quantitative detail and structure correctly reproduced by simply the linear spin wave theory and by the molecular dynamic simulations. And so the question is why? Yeah?
Is there any experimental resolution convoluted with your theory, or is that just your theory?
Just a second. Okay, I don't know, but we have so few sharp features that I doubt this makes a big difference. At low energies, there are real deviations, and it's actually the numerics, the experiment is quite sharp. So I don't think that we're actually limited by the resolution as such of the experiment. But okay, so how do we understand this? And so the basic idea is that what we're doing with spin wave theory here has a totally different justifications from the ones I showed a few pages earlier. Namely, what really this is a short time expansion, a short time description of what the dynamics is doing. So the classical picture, I'm taking you back to this picture here, where you have the ground states embedded in the full phase space. So you've got two types of modes, the one parameterized by x in the ground state, the one's parameterized by y out of the ground state. And the important thing is that the type 2 modes out of the ground state form a broad continuum. So this is basically what's shown here. So both in Q space and in omega space, you have very broad features. So even if these excitations now decay after a relatively short period of time, this time can still be relatively long compared to the sort of natural line width, which is basically the full spectral width. So in other words, the lifetime broadening is unimportant compared to the intrinsic breadth of the signal that you have here. So in other words, even though the spin waves may not live a very long time, that lifetime is still big compared to the intrinsic width of the signal here. Okay. The other thing is that the spectrum of this type, so what we're definitely missing is the evolution of the x-coordinate here, because in linear spin wave theory it doesn't evolve at all, whereas in reality it does. You can check that in the Landau-Lifshitz equations of motion. But now the important thing is that the spectrum of the y-modes is actually statistically constant along here. So in other words, you've got self-averaging. If you look at a sufficiently large system, it doesn't change at all as the x-coordinates evolves. So here I'm showing this for a system, I think, of a few hundred spins for a single shot, 10 shots and 250 shots, and you see that already the single shot is almost the same as the average over 250 such states. So in other words, the system essentially is sufficiently delocalized to just exhibit self-averaging, and the fact that linear spin wave theory does not see the X modes evolving is actually not something that you see in the spectrum of the Y modes. Okay, so this is then the final conclusion here. So the reason things work in the pyroclore lattice for spin one, I don't know why it works so well, but the reason it essentially works here is because there's a new field of applicability of spin wave theory, namely in the case where you've got a disordered ground state or a set of disordered ground states which are self-averaging, and where what you see in finite frequencies is essentially the short time behavior. Okay, so what I've tried to tell you about is spin waves beyond the many body systems beyond the universal regime. So spin wave descriptions in the square lattice work very well across the full spectrum. For the triangular lattice, single particle descriptions work well by level repulsion. And for the pyroclore lattice, they work well as a short time description. And so this is what I meant by the surprising usefulness of spin waves. So they're basically ways that spin wave single particle descriptions can be useful even in settings where they, where the normal ideology doesn't have them survive. Okay, I believe that this is quite generic behavior, and so I've tried to identify some behavioral classes, including some simple criteria, and of course the idea is that this should apply to quasi-particles in general. Okay, so I think I'll leave it there. Thank you very much for your attention.
Are there questions, comments?
I have an apologies if it's too technical, but so the question I have is about how the spin wave were calculated from Monte Carlo. So let's say you have a cluster, right, and then you start with some random non-coplanar spin configuration. So typically the way I would do spin wave calculation, you would have to on each side redefine its new z axis, call it z, expand the spin waves around this. And personally, I've done it for probably the largest cell I tried myself with something like six sides. Then you have Boglubov-Degen. You have about matrices 12 by 12. And if you try to do it analytically, it's a mess. You have to do MATLAB or Mathematica. Here we are talking about Monte Carlo, so presumably hundreds of sites. Yeah. How was this automated?
Yeah, we didn't do it analytically. So you basically do do the Boglubov. So you construct a dynamical matrix, essentially, in this, the way that you say. Then you do Boglubov transformation on it. Since we're interested in the finite energy mode, we don't have to worry too much about the Jordan blocks, which the 2x2 Jordan blocks. But then the thing just, since you're expanding around ground state, it just spits out a set of frequencies. Mm-hmm. These frequencies come with modes, and the modes are what went into the structure factor calculation. It literally is the eigenvectors there, and the density of states. I'm not sure I showed this anywhere, but this is of course implicit in the omega part. Right, so if you resolve the modes as a function of omega, then you get this.
That's right. So in the end, it's just a problem with a very large matrix for which you have to.
So Boglubov transformations are more painful than unitary diagonalizations, but you basically just do that and then you get this out. Yeah.
Okay.
So I think this is probably very naive. So you made the question, you made the point that this would apply to other quasi-particles, and you showed liquid helium. But does the same sort of physics come up with more conventional phonons like that you would have
okay.
in silicon?
Okay. So in doing all of this, I realized that there are a lot of things about spin wave theory which I really hadn't appreciated before. So and when I say that there were some things. Yeah, they're mainly my own misconceptions. So one is that, so spin wave theory, if you say is controlled in 1 over S, then this is correct in the sense that, or it's only correct in the sense that higher order terms come with a 1 over S prefactor, right? There, it's actually controlled in some other things as far as I'm concerned, but never mind. So often the thought was that if the magnons start decaying, then that's somehow linear spin wave theory is breaking down. And you might say, okay, for linear spin wave theory breaking down, this is correct. But spin wave theory correctly describes the breakdown, you know, the decay of magnons, right? It's then when you go to stronger 1 over s, so to smaller spins, that I think spin wave theory correctly predicts the level of ejection, even though these calculations become very hard, okay? But there's a very nice setup where you can see how different things happen. Now, if you want to do the same thing for the anharmonic terms and say phonons, you suddenly realize that it's not clear what 1 over s means. So what's the effective H bar for a phonon? And perhaps the thing, we haven't done this, but perhaps the thing would be to either look at very high energy phonons or perhaps to look at phonons closer to whatever melting or something like this. But I think the great advantage of spin waves really is that you have 1 over s as a parameter distinguishing the anharmonic terms from the harmonic terms, and that you can then tune through those. And of course that you've got frustrated magnets is another very useful thing. So again, you might want to ask what is the frustrated version of a phonon spectrum, but I'm sure Vincenzo has got some thoughts on that. So, right. But I think the analogy isn't totally direct, but I also think that this may be useful perspective to take on other quasi-particles, which people haven't taken yet.
Do you know of any experiments other than, I mean, the liquid helium one is quite famous, and I can't think of a phonon spectrum that I've seen in a simple solid that shows anything equivalent.
No, I mean, I was actually thinking something similar. So one of the really remarkable things here is how little thought seems to have gone into these. So this is why I said in the beginning, do we think quasi-particles are ubiquitous because we simply stay away from regimes where they are not so frequently encountered? Of course, energy scales work out differently. So one might want to look at some rather soft solids, because if you go to an experimentalist who measures phonons and you tell me, could you not just tell us the spectrum at 800 Kelvin, then the answer is, well, I don't particularly feel like building a furnace just to measure anharmonic phonons. So it's these kind of things, but a little bit like with neutrons, when the technology is there, suddenly you've got the data, and then it's really up to the theorists to do something about it.
I think this is related to Bruce's question. So in the same picture of the level, the single particle of the continuum, the level repulsion. Mm-hmm. So I understand it's as you tune the coupling constant at some when it's strong enough, apparently there's a repulsion, and when it's weak enough, there's no repulsion. So how is there a simple picture for, like, how generic is this? So if I give you any two particle continuum and a single particle continuum, and I couple them with something, if I increase the coupling strength, will they repel at some point, or how
well?
So the
way the limit can happen in a non-singular way is that the weight that you expel drops rapidly, and the distance to the bottom end of the continuum vanishes, and so then that for any finite resolution, you're not going to see that there's something missing there, right? So the statement is, if you make the repulsion strong enough, then you can get as much as half of the weight being expelled out of the continuum. The other half will always remain there. So it's not like the full mode gets expelled. And then the functional form of how much of that weight there is expelled and how far it is from the bottom layer is what depends on all the details I mentioned.
But I see that you assumed a flat band for the...
That doesn't matter.
It doesn't depend on dimensionality and the dispersion and nothing.
Enters in the density of states, yeah.
So is there a dimensionality for which it doesn't occur and for which it does occur?
So the effect has different strengths and different dimensions. Uh-huh. So, right. But then, it depends on, say, if your minimum, the two-particle continuum happens to be... what's the nature of the minimum? You can again say if it were quartic or quadratic, then you'd also get different behavior. But all of this you can put in an effective density of states, so the dimensionality doesn't autonomously enter outside the density of states.
It's very straightforward to write down a linear spin wave for ferromagnet, anti-ferromagnet, helicoidal structure. But for sinusoidal structures, like sinusoidal spin density wave, when the length of spin nominally changes, ordered spin, it's rather difficult really to write down spin wave spectrum. Are there any simple way to deal with this? In helicoidal, you can simply rotate the axis and so on, but in sinusoidal spin density wave for sinusoidal structure, spin structure. Rather non-trivial stuff.
Okay, I haven't thought about that. I'm, for the purpose of the questions I've been posing here, I'm not sure whether the effective length of the ordered moment enters in a particularly fundamental way, but I, off the top of my head, I can't give you a precise answer to that question.
Maybe comment on Daniel's question. So I think what you're referring to is indeed true in many itinerant magnets. I think here, by the virtue of the spin wave theory. I see. Okay. Well, so, the point well taken, and I don't know the answer to this. I know that, well, I thought about this, but I don't know how to apply spin wave to when the size of the spin is actually changing.
Well, it's not a complete answer, but there are controlled examples in one dimension where you can study things like that. People have looked at dynamics in DMRG. I'm not aware of any controlled calculation in higher dimension. Sure, but I think this is Roderick's question time, so.
Yeah, okay, and I can't give you an answer.
So you can get these things from multiple Q states. You need a longitudinal order. You can get fluctuations about that. The only really controlled calculations I know about are in 1D.
So what will be the really physical origin of this success? I mean, if we have to kind of rationalize in a physical way, not in terms of calculation.
So I think the statement is that even the short-lived, so if you think of spin wave as describing the precession of a spin, I think the statement is that the spin, even though the spin wave is short-lived, still just about manages one or several rotations, mm-hmm. and that's enough for a signal this wide, this broad, to be reproduced correctly.
So we should really redefine the scope of spin wave.
No, I mean, I think there's a lot of there's a certain lack of clarity where the theories are controlled in certain settings and they work in settings which may be a lot broader than this. And I think I've given you an instance of the second and not the first one.
Right. So I have a question on your spin one system.
Yeah.
So of course, you have this sodium-calcium issue there. And as far as I understood, basically, you think this may only affect some broadenings, but it's not really worrying you that this may be also a cause for not having an ordered state at some
right.
low temperature, correct?
Yeah. okay, so for the... For theoretical classical model systems, we know the behavior with bond disorder very well. So there's some ancient work of Peter Holdsworth, Michels, and myself, but then much more recent and much more complete by John Shawker and students. Mm-hmm. And there, what you find is a freezing transition at a temperature which is set not by J, but by the size of the disorder. Right. So then the question is the disorder 3.5 Kelvin or is it 35 Kelvin? If it's 35 Kelvin, then there's a problem. If it's 3.5 Kelvin, there's no problem.
So you may think there is the region of spin
that's
wave,
right.
but you may
that's right.
go into
right.
this other region.
And since the frozen moment is only 10%, it's sort of unlikely that the disorder is 35 Kelvin.
Okay. If there are no further questions, let's thank the speaker again and move on to the...